Welcome to Agency of the Month, brought to you by the CSC NGEN team on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. This month's agency is Navy.
Welcome to the program. Today's conversation to launch the Agency of the Month series for March is Vice Admiral Philip Cullum, Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Fleet Readiness and Logistics. Admiral, pleasure to have you as our first guest on Agency of the Month.
Thank you.
Your portfolio focuses on energy use in the Navy. Talk about where the Navy stands today in energy use, the types, and the issues that you're dealing with when it comes to energy consumption.
Sure. Well, as you know, for instance, the military uses a lot of energy, and much of it is in the form of liquid petroleum. In the Navy's case, roughly three-quarters of our energy usage is actually tactical in nature, and one-quarter of it happens ashore, the energy use that we make on our bases and installations around the country and around the world, actually. And in terms of the actual product that we use, about 55% of our actual energy sources is in the form of petroleum afloat. So pretty clearly that occupies an awful lot of our focus in terms of what we're doing for an energy program. We also use nuclear fuel, obviously, for our submarines and aircraft carriers. And then we do have other sources, and particularly ashore, the vast majority of the energy demand is met through the electricity that's pulled off of the grid.
Mm-hmm.
But we are increasingly starting to use a lot of alternatives and clearly pushing ahead in that very strongly in meeting both the Secretary of the Navy's goal as well as the President's goal for 1 gigawatt.
You mentioned alternative fuels, and there's a tremendous amount of interest in alternative fuels across the Pentagon. Talk about where the Navy is exploring in particular in alternative fuels, both ashore and at sea.
I'm actually going to probably take a right-hand turn on this. And what I mean by that is that, you know, many people are captivated by the whole issue of alternative energy as part of our strategy. And it's clear why, because that is kind of captivating when we all look at $3.50 a gallon that we're all paying at the pump or higher. I think I heard yesterday that there was one station that was at $5 a gallon premium.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I haven't paid that yet, but that's a sobering thought, I think, for all of us. So we all would like to get off the oil kick if we can. Now, that said, for us, we have a holistic energy plan for the Navy, and that really to us means judicious use or I would call it Spartan use of energy, particularly afloat.
Mm-hmm.
Because for us, the energy usage that we have and being more efficient in that energy usage is actually the most important thing. 95% of our program for next year, for instance, in terms of energy initiatives, actually focuses on efficiency, not necessarily just on alternatives. Now, that said, the alternatives part is still very important. But let me just say that the effort that we have put onto the efficiency side buys us combat capability. If we're more efficient, we'll have greater endurance. We'll be able to conduct our mission longer. And I think as we've all seen play out on the battlefield in Iraq and Afghanistan, it can also potentially be our vulnerability. So if we can be able to not be as wedded to that fuel, then we can be more resilient on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
That gives us more combat capability. So that's why we've focused a lot on that. Now, going to the alternatives discussion, and that certainly, I know when we've flown the Green Hornet and we've operated a Riverine boat, and we've now actually tested out almost every single engine that's in the Navy inventory, whether it be shipboard or an airplane aircraft in the air in the Navy inventory. We've operated them on various kinds of biofuels, various kinds meaning that they come from various feedstocks.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them come from a camelina, a mustard seed. Some of those come from algae, and all of those help us to be able to diversify that usage of just one singular asset of petroleum. Essentially, and what it does in a few days or weeks of either growing it or in terms of fermenting it, we do what nature takes millions of years to do underground.
Last time you and I spoke, we talked about the concept of drop-in fuel. Flesh that out a little bit. Explain what that means, please.
Sure, absolutely. And I'll draw a parallel to what you and I see at the gas pump.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, right now, today, we all actually operate on biofuel. 10% of what we put in our tank is ethanol, and so we are actually using biofuel every day. Now, we also see that there's E85 pumps out there, and not every car can actually operate on E85. You have to be specially configured to do that. Drop-in replacement means that what we want to be able to do is to be able to use significant amounts of biofuel, but not have to change the engines and not have to change out the way we store it, the way we transfer it, or any aspect associated with our current configuration in the Navy. A lot of that's because we've already spent billions of dollars on planes and ships and submarines and oilers and all things that move that energy resource around the world so that we can use it to conduct military missions. And we sure wouldn't want to have to reinvent all that or re-engine everything.
Mm-hmm.
So having a drop-in replacement that looks, smells, and acts just like petroleum, yet actually comes from a different source. It's mm-hmm. not from petroleum. It comes from a bio component, whether it's a waste component, waste oils and things like that, or from something that you grow either in the ground or something you grow from algae.
What are the most successful forms of these that you've tested so far in the inventory that you have?
Well, the first out of the gate, the ones that have come to commercialization fastest are either come from something you grow on the ground. So that's very similar in some ways to the technology that was applied to produce ethanols, corn, and things like that,
mm-hmm.
except it's very different. What we're looking at is things that don't require a lot of water, that can be grown on less than good land, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So it's arable land, but it's not something that you would otherwise want to plant things for food, for corn or potatoes or any other vegetable or fruit. That allows us to be able to use areas that are probably cheaper to be able to grow things on, and things that places of the country that currently aren't growing anything. And that's in some measure camelina. There's other things, jatropha. There's switchgrasses and other types of things like that that can also be used in a similar vein, a
mm-hmm.
similar way, a similar process to get you to a biocrude that can ultimately be refined to a drop-in replacement. Another option is something that doesn't require any significant amount of land, and that's the algae component, algae as a feedstock. Algae can be done in a couple of different ways, open farming, if you will, of the algae, or closed bioreactors.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different processes that are being experimented with now, some of which have reached commercialization, some of which have not yet reached commercialization.
The backdrop for just about every conversation that goes on right now about anything in the Department of Defense is the budget. Talk about how much of this exploration and research and experimentation is budget-based and how much of it is need-based or operations-based or any combination thereof.
There is a certain component of both of those in our program and our exploration of the alternative fuels. But I would say it's also really neither. Our energy program is more than anything, it's based on trying to improve and enhance the combat capability of our ships and planes and submarines so that we can do more of the mission set. And I'll give you the example from World War II was what Doolittle did during his raid, where he took his B-25, stripped them out, made them lighter, taught his pilots how to fly very differently than they had flown before,
mm-hmm.
and then conducted a mission that no one thought was ever going to be possible, which is having a B-25 take off from an aircraft carrier and then conduct a mission hundreds and hundreds of miles away from its intended target. That's the kind of extrapolation that we can do if we have the right mindset to this. So the eye of the needle for all of the initiatives that we're pursuing is that. On the alternative fuels lane, when we look at that, there is a budget portion of this and a supply portion of this. Because I'll give you an example. The Navy last year in 2011 spent $4.7 billion on liquid fuel. And when the price per barrel went up $10 a barrel, what ended up happening is we spent $1.3 billion more for fuel. Well, that's unsustainable for the long haul as we look at where oil comes from and the fact that we don't have a lot of that in the United States, yet we consume about a quarter of it within the United States writ large.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, again, because the military uses a lot of energy to move thousands and thousands of pounds of military equipment, we know that we're pretty wedded to either that or some other kind of liquid fuel if we can't find some other radical alternative that's vastly different from a tactical perspective.
You're listening to Agency of the Month on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is Navy Vice Admiral Philip Cullum, Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Fleet Readiness and Logistics. We'll continue our conversation in a moment.
CSC stands ready to partner with the Department of Navy on Next Generation Enterprise Network to achieve a fully integrated naval networking environment. The world-class CSC team, including Harris, General Dynamics IT, and Verizon, has the experience to deliver innovative networking solutions that enhance performance, improve security, and cut costs to affordably meet evolving needs of sailors and Marines today and for years to come. Visit NGenReady.com for more information. That's NGenReady.com.
Welcome back to Agency of the Month on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is Navy Vice Admiral Philip Cullum. He's Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Fleet Readiness and Logistics. Admiral, we talked about alternative forms of fuel in the first part of our program. Some of those forms are things that people are not familiar with on a day-to-day basis. Explain what some of these sources are and where they come from originally.
Camelina, for instance, as a mustard seed, has a lot of oil in it. The seed itself has a lot of oil. So you can grow it like any other kind of grass or a rice or something like that, but you can grow it on land that's pretty rocky and doesn't have a lot of good nutrients in the soil, and it really doesn't require a lot of water.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to irrigate it. So again, it gives you some advantages that you don't have if you're talking about corn itself. So that as a feedstock, along with things like switchgrasses and other things, have tremendous possibility in being able to, and not just probability, we've actually are using that to power the Green Strike Group here this summer. Some portion of that, actually, for this summer, a lot of that fuel, which is this hydro-renewable treated F-76 and JP-5, come from either waste oils, so mm-hmm. you can use things that come from chicken processing plants or animal processing plants. Those oils can be changed and altered into a biocrude that you can then turn into jet fuel. So that's a completely different kind of thing in terms of the feedstock itself. And I'll tell you, one of the things that's very exciting on the horizon are things that are today truly waste products. We do a lot of growing of trees and we create a lot of lumber in this country. We export a lot of that, but there's a lot of waste that's left over from that industry. As it turns out, there are processes available now where you can convert that waste and actually turn it into a biocrude as well. So being able to do a cellulosic reduction of these waste products and you know, I just used the lumber industry as one example, but there are many others as well. And I'll give you another example. Something that we're partnered and working with NASA on is to be able to take human waste and be able to put that into polyurethane bags and inoculate it with an algae. And 7 days later, roughly, plus or minus, you get, with a little bit of wave action and a little bit of exposure to the sun, you get a basis of a biocrude. So you can then take that and then use human waste into fuel.
You mentioned this is a cultural issue, and the reputation inside DOD is that culture is difficult to change sometimes. What are some of the success stories that you have or best practices that you have at changing the culture in this particular sphere?
Well, as I mentioned, the first one is to actually get the educational institutions within the Navy to embrace not just an awareness of this, but to actually couple students' interests in this arena, which we've seen. We had no trouble getting the first group of students, number of volunteers, to sign up for this major. That's kind of one indicator. But what it also allows us to do is to lash up with both industry and other universities around the country and to be able to infuse and bring that knowledge back into the Navy. Now, one of the other successes in this is that we are now going to track all these officers as they get this education throughout their careers with a subspecialty code, so we'll know who our energy warriors are around the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, the new fleet award for battle efficiency that includes energy in it. Additionally, the aviation community within the Navy, we call the head of that community the Air Boss. The Air Boss has put out a message to all of aviation, naval aviation, about an energy conservation program. And that's getting kicked off to incentivize the energy conservation within the aviation world, where clearly to move a piece of steel through the air at Mach 1 point something is not an easy task, and it consumes a massive amount of energy.
Mm-hmm.
As well on the shipboard side, we've actually had an energy conservation program around for a long time, for at least a decade, a little bit over a decade. We're now going to further incentivize that and couple it with some new technologies to allow the ships to be able to be that much more efficient as well. So those are, you know, just a few of the things, you know, right off the top of my head I can think of that just on the culture side of the house that we're doing. Another piece of it too is that it doesn't do any good just to just try to be more efficient with the gear that we have out there now, because we're building new stuff all the time. Most of the new stuff, if you believe the co-founder of Intel, Mr. Gordon Moore, and you believe that every generation of new technology is going to require that many more things on the circuit board,
mm-hmm.
and you think about what that means for power, it's going to require that much more power. Now, we've found ways to get around some of that, but generally speaking, each new generation comes along and requires that much more power. Well, we've got to change the way we do acquisition of our things. And within the Navy, the Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Research and Development in June published a memo requiring that as we build new weapon systems and planes and ships, they will be, not could be or should be, but will be energy efficient. And that's fundamentally transforming how we design and build both ships and aircraft.
Now, you mentioned Moore's Law as it pertains to power. Are you seeing Moore's Law applicable, at least in some form, on the price-cost side of the arc, too, where the price goes down as the power increases, or are we not quite to that point yet?
That's actually a challenging question to answer, because there's a lot of things that affect whether or not the power will actually become cheaper as we have new technologies. But I will tell you that there's research and development work ongoing for next-generation ships that we're going to be putting out, where that's an essential piece of it, is that we are designing the technology so that it is more power dense,
mm-hmm.
and therefore also smaller, as well as more energy efficient along the way. And the two of those things will work to return us more combat capability as a result of having it be able to be smaller, have longer endurance, better power storage, also to be able to frankly have bidirectional flow of power from DC to AC, AC to DC, so that we can, much like the Prius, is able to move between its battery and the reciprocating engine,
mm-hmm.
is able to move that power back and forth.
It sounds like the vision is broader than what I was thinking, which is the unit cost is not as critical as the overall mission cost. You're accomplishing the same or more mission for the same or less money.
The overall mission cost, that's correct, particularly from a life cycle costing.
Mm-hmm.
So what I mean by that is we own a ship for 40 years for the average destroyer that we have out there today. And if you're going to own that over 40 years, you know, what component of that is the energy that, you know, you need to spend? What portion is personnel? What portion is all the factors and the components, mm-hmm. of that total cost? We are increasingly focused on each and every one of those things, not just the initial procurement cost.
Tell me about something that you mentioned earlier, and that is the Green Strike Group.
Sure. Green Strike Group is, we are planning on having the Green Strike Group go out for RIMPAC 2012. That's this summer. It's a Rim of the Pacific exercise out in the mid-Pacific. Many nations participate in it, but a few of the U.S. ships that will participate in that, and it's a strike group of ships, so an aircraft carrier, the air wing associated with that aircraft carrier, a cruiser, and a couple of destroyers, will all operate on alternative fuel for a defined period of time, roughly, probably a little less than a week.
Mm-hmm.
And the point of that really is that we look at it as a gold mine of operational testing. And we've done the controlled tests of each of these engines in very limited tests for a few hours here. And we believe that that testing verifies to us that this fuel is both safe to operate, gives us the combat capability we need, does not have any adverse effects in the near term or medium term or even the long term, but there's nothing like a operational test and demonstration, a test evaluation and demonstration that's cross-platform across both the oiler that's going to deliver it and transfer it to the ships or to the aircraft carrier, pumping it up to the aircraft itself, looking at how the tanks perform after several days of having that fuel in it. Those things, we haven't been able to put all that together. Asking the operators, okay, what did you see? Did you see something that we didn't see when the scientists and the engineers looked at it in the very controlled environment? And so that's why we're doing that this summer, and that we believe is going to give us a good operational test of whether or not this is going to be something that will have unrestricted use and that we'll be able to sign off and say that when we're able to get the industry to get this down to a competitive price,
mm-hmm.
That it'll be open for free use by all the operating forces and be able to use seamlessly so that the CO of a ship or the pilot that's getting into his Hornet, his F-18, doesn't care whether he has biofuel in his tank or he's got petroleum. And frankly, because it's that drop-in replacement, whichever one is cheaper, we can certainly go by that. That mm-hmm. gives us that resilience from the volatility of the fuel.
Admiral, I appreciate your time today. Thank you very much for coming in and talking to us.
Well, thank you very much, Francis. It was a pleasure.
Vice Admiral Philip Cullum is Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Fleet Readiness and Logistics on Agency of the Month on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Please listen next week at this same time for my conversation with Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Financial Management and Comptroller Gladys Commons.
You've been listening to Agency of the Month, brought to you by the CSC NGEN team on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Search Navy. Agency of the Month, Thursday mornings at 10 a.m., only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, your source for federal news now. CSC stands ready to partner with the Department of Navy on Next Generation Enterprise Network to achieve a fully integrated naval networking environment. The world-class CSC team, including Harris, General Dynamics IT, and Verizon, has the experience to deliver innovative networking solutions that enhance performance, improve security, and cut costs to affordably meet evolving needs of sailors and Marines today and for years to come. Visit NGenReady.com for more information. That's NGenReady.com.